Let's Talk Development, Season 2, Episode 11.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Development, a podcast series of CDPR. I'm Uzma Afzal, and I'm an applied micro-experimental economist, and my work mostly lies in the intersection of development economics, gender, and household dynamics. Until recently, I was an assistant professor at the Lahore University of Management Sciences, and I'll be joining another economics department at RMIT soon. Today, I am joined by my co-author and a dear friend, Dr. Farah Saeed, who is the executive director at the Mehboobul Haq Research Center and an assistant professor at Lahore University of Management Sciences, LUMS. Farah is an applied microeconomist, and her work focuses on issues related to gender development and access to finance. So today we will be talking about gender and productivity, a topic which is significantly important to Pakistan's economic progress. And just to set up the background and the topic of our discussion today, Pakistan has one of the lowest female labor force participation rates in South Asia. It's around 22% compared to 35% in Bangladesh and 37% in India. And so basically about half of our population is largely untapped in formal employment. Beyond overall participation, there are significant micro-level disparities in wages, job types, and career progression. Women in Pakistan are often concentrated in low-paying, informal, or home-based work with limited job security. And even among the highly educated women, wage gaps and glass ceilings persist, making career advancement extremely difficult. This essentially translates into Pakistan being at the bottom of the Global Development Index and closing the gender gap, according to one report by the McKinsey Global Institute, states that if we did manage to close the gender gap, Pakistan could actually increase its GDP by about 30%. So the gender gap in economic participation is not just about employment, but it affects broader societal outcomes, including household income, child welfare, and overall economic resilience. And when women work, it contributes to poverty reduction and economic stability at both the household as well as the national level. So given the current situation, Farah, my first question to you is, how does gender inequality in employment impact Pakistan's economic growth and productivity? And what benefits could Pakistan unlock by achieving gender parity in the labor force?
Thank you, Uzma, for taking out the time as well. I mean, I just wanted to say you're just as much of an expert that I am on these things. So I'm really looking forward to having this discussion with you. So going towards your question, I think as you've indicated, there are substantial gains according to different estimates in the GDP of the country. But just to put this into perspective, I think some of the things that the estimates are basing this on, so some estimates base this on us achieving the same female labor force participation as other low and middle income countries, which is quite a bit higher than Pakistan's. And so that is where we get the 30%. Some more conservative figures give 23%. But even if we go to our peers in the same region, for instance, if we try to come close to the GDP, participation rate in Bangladesh, even then this is a substantial increase of approximately 5 to 10%. So there are gains to be had regardless of what kind of estimates you make. I think you were also asking about some of the more sectoral kind of GDP gaps that we see. We do have the labor force participation that we have for women, about 25% for the last a decade or so. It's mostly concentrated in areas where there are low growth, essentially, and they're underrepresented in leadership across different sectors. We see a lot of labor force participation, education, healthcare, where career opportunities are kind of limited. So there is documentation of this glass ceiling effect where you prevent female teachers and nurses from advancing into managerial positions or having a career growth just by the kind of sector they're in. In other sectors where we see a lot of female participation, other countries, for instance, you mentioned textiles. So in Bangladesh, they're actively integrated into textile exports, leading to higher productivity and economic growth. And so that's one of the things that we see as being posited as the impetus to kind of the growth that Bangladesh saw. But in Pakistan's textile industry, we underutilize the female labor force. And that potentially limits the national economic gains. I also want to add that in addition to this, where we see a lot of underrepresented or perhaps undercounted labor force participation is in informal work. So we don't actually know how many women are working. We suspect there are quite a few. And for sure, we suspect that the labor force participation in informal sectors is more than in the formal sectors. But even there, the growth is limited. So they may be home-based workers, or they may be working in agriculture. These lack formal contracts, social protection, access to productive resources, reducing their ability to grow. So some of my own work, which has been supported by IGC and the CDPR, is that women in the low to middle income strata, they struggle to find time to dedicate to their work, even if it's a business that they're running from home. And they often do not have access to the right kind of finance, which may have to be a bit more flexible than the normal generic loans that we have in the market. And that limits their profitability compared to, let's say, the same sector or the same business being operated by a male. So even if the entrepreneurial ability is the same, there are other constraints that keeps productivity low as long as they're in these sectors. So we know that in evidence from other countries like in Mexico and India, that women are often put into lower paid, less prestigious position. We have a strong suspicion this is the same for Pakistan based on what limited data we have. And as I said, in the informal sector, we expect this to be even higher, not lower. You mentioned that the impacts at the macro level could be reduced by increasing the GDP. But I just want to mention before I stop, one study that has been done by Navashraf and others, where they look at this data from a multinational company. So across different countries, and they notice that in most countries, there are fewer women working than men in this highly paid MNC. But that this ratio is more skewed in countries where women find it harder to leave the home for work. And Pakistan is one of those countries. And they estimate that if we just reduce the gender gap, you know, they qualify this. And the interesting qualification is that the women who are working are more productive than the men who are working. And this is kind of reasonable also because there may be some positive selection going on. Women who get to work in this company and then persist are probably quite productive. But they say, you know, even if we reduce the, you know, eliminate the gender gap and we make the productivity the same for men and women, even then the growth for this one company is to increase its productivity by 32%. And in Pakistan in particular, by 90%. So it's doubling the productivity. So across the country, yes, but even in terms of smaller single firms, there are massive gains to be had by just maybe reaching the same kind of participation rates that we see in our peer countries that are stronger.
So this is a good segue into my next question, which is actually on productivity. So how do gender dynamics in Pakistan impact workplace productivity? So for example, like you also mentioned that Pakistan, the women are mostly concentrated in specific sectors such as education, you have healthcare, you have textiles, often roles with very limited career development. And additionally, there are these challenges of restricted mobility, lack of workplace facilities. You don't have childcare. Safe transport is a big issue. There's work done by other researchers recently on safe transportation as well. And societal norms, which limit women from working long hours, limit women from taking up leadership roles. So how can all of these factors affect productivity and shape the national productivity levels?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think, as you've said, there are multiple barriers, but we have to think of this in a context of where ability is not different between men and women. And then we have to wonder, why is it that women are consistently working in lower paid sectors or lower paid jobs? And those are some of the reasons are the ones that you've mentioned. There are many other barriers other than the financial incentives that are stopping women from perhaps going in the places that they may prefer to work in or where the wages are slightly higher. So if I just take a couple of examples that you gave, I think one of the biggest things that we don't consider, often consider, I know people who are working in the sector do, but perhaps policymakers don't consider that as much, are intra-household norms. And we have work on this, right? We have work. This has again been supported by IGC, which I do want to give a shout out to because there is a great gender focus on that. And I really do appreciate the support that they provided. And basically what we see is that household norms kind of dictate that women need explicit permission from men in the family. And it's not implicit. It's not that, as long as he's not stopping me from working, I can work. It's an explicit permission to work that you need before you can go to A, outside of the home to work, and then where you are going to work. And then in addition, you also consider that a lot of times you don't have transport. And so this is a household member who's going to be taking you back and forth between the workplace and your home. So you're very reliant on them. And so this acts as a major barrier to the labor force participation. And so we've seen in studies where women are able to convince their male relatives or involve their male relatives into their decision-making. This increases women's retention in a job. So not necessarily that they start to apply more, but if they are at work, they're likely to stay at work if the family members buy into it. This takes me to the second point that you mentioned, which is kind of related, which is social norms. So outside of the household, what is the society thinking? And so there we have social norms that say women should, you know, perhaps not leave the household, or if they are leaving the household, perhaps not go beyond the, you know, the neighborhood or what is considered a safe boundary. And so there's this excellent work by Ali Chima, Farooq Nasir, Asim Khwaja, and others, which is, you know, it's based on a vocational training in Punjab. And they essentially found that women are willing to forego this free vocational training if it meant that they had to leave the village boundary for it. So there's an invisible boundary that is formed across where it is not appropriate for women to go. And that it's not just financial incentives that you could provide. So I think they provided financial incentives, which were as much as 50% of the household monthly income. And the women were still not leaving until they provided safe transport. And so that kind of broke the barrier. And so, you know, this is in the rural area, but we have similar results from urban areas by work done in Lahore, where job search behavior is significantly lower among women, where opportunities require commuting. So we've done this recent pilot with women who drive rickshaws or actually apply for funding for rickshaws. And we saw that at baseline, before we could provide these assets, less than 10% of the women working were using public buses or private wagons. And they were citing safety. So they weren't citing that there's no access. They were citing safety concerns and reliability concerns. So the bus does not come on time and that I miss getting to work on time, or, you know, harassment on buses and violence is common. Walking is actually considered safer. Rickshaw is considered much safer, more reliable. It's private. It's an enclosed space. There are people around you who you can trust, etc. But that comes at a high cost. So women who use rickshaws say that it takes us about 30 to 40 minutes to get to a place of work or any place, even a market that we need to go to. And it costs us about $250 per trip. And so for women who are being hired at low wages at about 11 to 13,000 per month, paying 250 one way per day or 500 per day amounts to quite a lot. So it just doesn't make financial sense for them to pursue such opportunities. The third big constraints that we have kind of uncovered is that women spend a lot of time on housework and care work, and that interferes with not just the skills upgrading that they may need, but also going to work. So they spend on average about 4 to 5 hours per day on unpaid care work, regardless of whether they're employed or not. So consider a woman who goes outside and spends 7 to 8 hours at work, then has to come back and spend 4 to 5 hours off care work. There's just not enough time left for any kind of productive work if that is the kind of equation they have to face. So this unequal distribution of care work really reduces the ability to participate in full-time employment. And I'm sure there are lots of high-ability women who are just not able to enter the labor force just for this reason. And finally, I'll go to the work that I've done most, which is on lack of access to finance. So because of that access to finance is limited, entrepreneurial ability is unable to lead to long-term growth. And linked to that is also employment networks. Some of our social norms prohibit women from building these networks, but these networks are absolutely essential for looking for work, for growing at work, career growth. Also, if you have a job and if you have a business, for just growing that business. And so that's also limited. So there's work that I've done, which is supporting this, but also work done by Job Portal, which is basically showing that the networks for women are smaller and less diverse, and this leads to less job referrals and less career growth. So I'll stop here. There are many other constraints, but I think I've taken a lot of time for just this response, but I'm happy to describe any of these in greater detail later.
Okay. So moving on, the next question kind of flows from what you've just talked about. So we understand issues such as poverty, limited access to resources, like you just mentioned, and discriminatory social norms which hinder productivity of marginalized communities, not just women, but other marginalized communities in other developing countries as well. So this is not just true for Pakistan, it's for other developing countries, but we've seen that countries like India, Bangladesh, Indonesia, they've implemented policies that have significantly increased labor force participation despite very similar constraints to Pakistan. So what lessons can Pakistan learn from these examples to enhance workforce inclusion and particularly for women in vulnerable communities?
So, you know, when we set up this meeting, this podcast, I was actually kind of excited about it because I think this may be an area that we work in, but this is an area where we have a lot of evidence. And so unlike other places where we don't know what is going to work and how we implement it, we actually have a lot of evidence that tells us exactly what works, when and where. So I think we have a lot to learn from these other countries, but also the substantial work now in Pakistan that can inform our decision making as well. So if we go back to the constraints that we just talked about, let's look at mobility, for example. The solution there is actually quite simple. If mobility is constrained, even in urban areas, you provide safe transport options. And so by safe transport options, we did have a pink bus service, which was, I mean, I don't see a lot of them now. I think they've been discontinued for some time. So it's not a reliable service that was provided in the first place. There were perhaps enough buses, but that's the kind of solution we need at scale. So we have pilot work done in Lahore, which shows that when women are provided with female-only transport services, even if it's from the employer side and not the government, then their job search activity doubles, and you know, arguably the retention rates would do. And so mobility can be easily solved by just providing incentives to employers to provide the service. There are other studies. Again, I'm going to concentrate first on Pakistan, then move to other countries. So there are other studies which are showing very simple initiatives which encourage women to, number one, apply, and then apply to the right kind of job. So one is this online job portal that Kate Pibony and colleagues are working on. And the other one is on the timing of application that women are spending. So not only on the one end, making jobs more accessible via information provided through a job portal, but you could, I think they essentially provide reminders as well, and they provide some coaching services, and it has led to greater application rates at least. But also when you provide this coaching service. So it turns out that for men and women, at least highly educated men and women, so let's think about college graduates, at the time that they're graduating, the likelihood or their own perceived likelihood of applying to jobs is the same. So, you know, men graduate with the same aspirations as women, but then men end up with more jobs than women do. And so this work looks at the fact that, you know, what actually happens is that women don't apply soon enough, they apply too late. And by the time they apply, they underestimate how competitive the labor market is. Perhaps that's a lack of information or a lack of guidance on that front. And so they lose that opportunity. So this work, which is, I think, led by Oriana Bandiera, they found that if you just vary and encourage women to apply at the time of graduation, their application rates goes up, but also their acceptance rates go up. So women start entering the labor force. And such a simple initiative, more than coaching how to write your CVs and when to apply and where to apply, just, you know, making sure that they apply at the right time. So low-cost work around this, low-cost initiatives around this, basically showing that labor market outcomes can improve for women. Then we have work from other countries. So other low-income countries is basically what we want to focus on. So in the DRC and Burkina Faso, they had interventions which are focusing on the childcare aspect of it. So if you provide childcare, which is not, they weren't providing it by the government, they were providing it at the community level, community-based childcare programs. This significantly increased the number of hours that women could put at work and their earnings. And in Pakistan, we know that affordable childcare options remain very limited to certain socio-economic strata. They're supposed to be provided at all public offices, but we know that they're not. So this essentially forces many women to stay at home despite wanting to work. if you move away from childcare, we can move towards, and move away from mobility, we can think about skill upskilling, right? So upskilling or skill development, and that could help in a lot of export industries. So Bangladesh, when they had this textile industry boom, this is one of the things that they tried out, and it worked for them. And so this is something that we could very easily replicate in the case of Pakistan. So similar interventions could kind of transition women from low productive to high productive work. The other thing that Bangladesh was also doing was, at the macro level, they had export growth and tariff reductions, which were focusing on industries that where more women are likely to work, and that actually provided a boost. And all of this could lead to organic growth as well. So again, we have evidence from other countries, particularly for Bangladesh, when there is a boom in one industry, more and more women start working because it becomes more acceptable for women to work. And not just for women to work, but work at supervisory or higher up positions. So in Bangladesh, certainly we see that when men work under female supervisors, they become more open to working with women in leadership. And so that there's a shift in the norms at the workplace, in the society, that happens with time. And that's our best expectation. So we do have a lot of evidence that indicates that work in very similar contexts, simple interventions, low-cost interventions that can increase women's access to the labor market and their ability to stay in the labor market. And so we know, as I said, we know what works, when it works, and how it works. And there's very strong evidence from Pakistan itself, even if you don't want to go to very similar contexts in our neighboring countries. And so now it's just a matter of implementing them at scale.
Yeah. So I think now moving on to what's more relevant nowadays. So we've just come out of a global pandemic. The concept of remote work has flourished all over. And now, and there's also a lot of digital advancement. So how has digital advancement and remote work impacted gender disparities in the labor markets, not just globally, but do you think this could be a game changer for Pakistan? For instance, considering constraints like childcare, we know it's a huge constraint for Pakistani women, limited safe transport. If they don't have to take that, if they don't have to leave their house and they have the opportunity to work at home, and if there are opportunities created, what impact do you think that can have? And additionally, how can this emerging technologies such as AI, online education, there are so many free platforms now, digital platforms, can empower women and marginalized communities in countries such as Pakistan?
So that's an excellent question. I think this is some of the things that at the university level, we often ponder, because when we think about what are the skills we need to provide to our graduates, these are things we're now thinking about, that it's a dramatically different job market than before. So there are definitely opportunities that come with these digital spaces, as well as AI-supported powered chatbots, et cetera. So if you just think about the fact that for a lot of women, access to skills upgradation is limited, then you have these digital educational platforms that can provide kind of personalized learning, and they can be tailored to women's schedules, so they don't have to worry about, as you say, you know, when they have childcare at home, they can just kind of work around that schedule. For women who are already working, for instance, let's say there's a female entrepreneur and she's thinking about how to run her business, these AI-powered chatbots can be quite useful in how they interact with clients and the questions that they're answering, the way that they communicate, essentially. And if they have any, you know, problems, they can actually just type in a question and get an answer from an AI, you know, something like ChatGPT. And so, again, there is some recent work that is showing that when women in particular gain access to financial services, digital financial services, at least, if nothing else, this is basically work in India, their business outcomes improve somewhat. And so there is, we do see this growth coming in. And then the third aspect is, in addition to flexible learning and entrepreneurship, you have this option of a different kind of work as well. You don't have to run your own business. You could do remote work. You could do freelancing. And as you said, you know, post-COVID, this has really picked up. The gig economy is now quite booming. But when it comes to Pakistan, so globally, we do see this impact. And globally, we also see some threat to how this may actually increase the gender gap as well. Is that some of the things that AI is replacing, for example, Those are things where it's either clerical work or administrative or supportive work, or you know, anything that can be automated. Women tend to work more in those sectors currently, and that is what AI is replacing. So it does mean that, you know, the burden on retraining is higher for women than for men. But that's on a global scale. We can expect that to be the case in Pakistan as well. But in addition, Pakistan has some additional constraints. So Pakistan still has one of the highest gender gaps, digital gender gaps in South Asia. Only about 15% of the women have regular access to internet, and about a similar low proportion has unmonitored access to mobile phones. And I'm very specifically saying unmonitored access to mobile phones, because they may have a mobile phone that they could occasionally get access to. This may be a phone that some other household member owns. But if it's an occasional access, and it's access which is heavily monitored in the sense, you know, what are you using this phone for? Who are you talking to? You know, it's all of those things. Then it's not something that can be used very productively for either remote work or for running a business or talking to your clients or any of those things. So that is a constraint that Pakistan faces. And this has come across in the kind of programs that the government also tries. So I believe some of our ex-colleagues from the Lahore School of Economics are working with the Punjab Skills Development Fund. And one of the things that I think I attended one of their presentations is they were saying, you know, the completion rates of these upskilling programs that could be provided at very subsidized cost is very low. So women do start, but at some point they drop out. And it's such a high number. I think it was around 8.5 or 9, you know, some extraordinary number that only about less than 10% of the women who enroll in that course actually finish it. So, and this is all related to access. What they do find is if you involve, for unmarried women, if you involve the parents and you tell them, you know, this is what we're doing online, this is what they're learning, perhaps you provide them with some financial incentives as well, then that boosts their completion rate. So I think the importance of autonomous access to phones cannot be understated in the case of Pakistan. It's another form of monitoring and policing that happens as it happens for in-person visits, and as it happens for women stepping outside of the households, it does happen on the phone as well. And we do know that there are, you know, cases of harassment online as well. So parents want to protect their daughters from it. And you know, it's basically essentially the same kind of concepts apply to the digital space, perhaps even more so, because you can't control who's viewing your content and who you're interacting with. And so that keeps the digital take-up in Pakistan low. So some of my other work that I do is on access to finance. And one of the things that we consistently struggle with is, unlike in other countries, the digital access in Pakistan for women is not increasing. And I, you know, I suspect this is, as I'm working on this, hopefully I'll have more results to show later, but I suspect this is it. So I suspect it's again monitoring, which keeps them from using either the internet or using their own phones. So, you know, even before we think about the risks that exist globally at the national level, I don't think we're positioned right now to take advantage of the opportunities that these digital spaces could provide. And AI at some point could be a threat to the gender gap. I think we're just not there yet. We will get there, though. So we should start thinking about it now, about how we want to make sure that the women are equipped as much as the men are equipped, in addition to the fact that we may want to rethink what kind of skills we want our highly educated graduates to have, because it's no longer what it used to be. With AI, the kind of skills that they need are now towards critical thinking and things that the AI cannot actually replicate. And so there's an entire rethinking of the structure that has to be done, keeping in mind, you know, being very conscious of the gender gap in access that exists.
Yes, I completely agree with all the points you made. And I think this could be a huge missed opportunity for us if we don't join the bandwagon of AI, and if there is digital access remains as limited as you say, and we see that it is in Pakistan. And again, it comes down to societal norms and controlling behavior towards women. But there's also the side where there's safety. There's not much safety. And monitoring online and of the digital space as such.
If I could also add, Usma, I think, because we may have time, and let me know if we don't, is also, I think there's this disconnect between, so we talked about a lot of evidence, and we know of more studies that we haven't included, but you and I are kind of familiar with because of the nature of the work that we do. I do want to maybe bring this to people's attention as well, that this is an area, because there's so much evidence that the glaring uptake in policy circles is, you know, it's kind of hard to ignore. So we do have a lot of discussion in policy roundtables where gender is thrown around a lot. And it's also, these are, you know, issues that are often just referenced in passing. It's remarkable that in each of these discussions that I've had, there's complete agreement. It's very hard to get people to agree on one issue, but gender is one issue that they agree with. And then despite it, you don't see follow through. So there is, you know, I think we need to think about what we could do to motivate more policy uptake of these issues. Some of the exercises that we were mentioning earlier about the calculation in GDP and the calculation in growth, I believe that was an attempt to maybe motivate that and show that this is, there are, you know, real gains to be had from this kind of reduction in the gender gap. I don't see a lot of momentum in it right now. I'm hoping it will come sometime in the future. But yeah, just wanted to raise this point as well before we end.
Yes, and I think this has been an extremely interesting discussion. There could be a lot more to talk about, even things like vocational training and why women are never really part of that. Okay, so thank you so much, Farah. This has been extremely interesting, and I have learned a lot from this discussion, and I hope people who've listened to this podcast found a lot of new things that they've learned from this discussion. I do hope that there's more political institutional commitment towards making gender inclusion a priority at the national level, and more policies are introduced to include women and enhance our labor force, female labor force participation. Thank you for the time, and goodbye. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Usma. Thank you. Bye.